Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett. Welcome to another edition of Speaking of Reliability. I'm here today with John Kruscher. Hi, John. How's it going?
Good, Adam. Good. Nice to see you. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you, too. It's been a little while since we did one-on-one. We collaborate in some different communities and get a chance to talk there. And actually, something you and I were just chatting about that comes directly from that is when we are conversing with other reliability experts, it's really interesting to hear how the reliability discipline is different in different industries. And you had said that for you, this is particularly interesting because you've only worked in one industry for your entire career, automotive.
That's right. I've been with automotive for 33 years. And, you know, when we get in these conversations, as we were talking about, it's really interesting because, you know, you think you know something about a topic and then somebody will bring up something that, you know, you've never touched. And it's pretty eye-opening, really.
What's one of the recent ones that you experienced that with?
Well, one in particular, we were talking about accelerated testing, and I know HALT is really big in the reliability community, but it's something that I haven't touched in my experience. So
wow,
that's
really?
That's really a blind spot for us. I think it's just turned out that we haven't needed it. You know, we do a lot in terms of reliability demonstration and quantitative ALT, accelerated life testing, but we really haven't been asked to by our customers, and we haven't. And frankly, you know, I realize the potential and the benefits of it, but it's not something that we pursued.
That's interesting, because you know, HALT's one of those getting to know what you don't know, right? Where it's the objective is to discover and have a chance to observe failure modes you didn't previously know could occur or you didn't know what they would look like. And so you guys, that's interesting. Just because your technology is so, you're so expert in it that there is this confidence that you do know what failure modes you're, you know, putting margin on and defending against and mitigating. And that as long as you are doing tests that help enforce or prove the fact that you have margin on those, that you're okay. And that sounds like it's proven to work.
Yeah, I think that's probably a lot of it. You know, I think, and it might be just that our development process, our development cycle is extensive enough that we feel like we've got a pretty good handle on what our failure modes are. And we've run it through its paces enough to kind of understand all of that.
Yeah. This is interesting. I think for me on this topic, one of the things, you know, having worked in a couple different industries and now as a consultant seeing, very diverse cross-section of industries, even at the same time, I'll have, you know, multiple customers in very different fields. For me, what I've noticed that's interesting is the balance of how reliability is weighted against other product objectives. So what I mean by that is when I worked in semiconductor developing ion implanters, the name of the game with ion implanters is latest technology, latest features. And your customers, the customers are people who make microchips, Intel, Motorola. And if you add a feature that they can make more chips per wafer or make them faster, they can, each one of those chips is worth so much money that it is worth that extra feature, even if it breaks 20% more of the time, it's still a net gain because that feature can add that much more value, which is shocking. So time to market and getting that latest feature out there, even with a lower reliability, in a lot of cases, they'd push a technology out so quick, they would hire a technician to live in that same town in Germany or whatever for a whole year, just so that they had instant repair. It was really worth pushing it to that edge. And then there's other industries I've worked for where any kind of failure is devastating because the, you know, competition is so fierce And so there's so little tolerance for any reliability issue that the idea of releasing something that could have a 2% higher failure rate would decimate your brand. And to dramatic extremes.
Yeah, that's the example you gave of the chip that certainly wouldn't fly in the auto industry. That's for sure. I had an assignment 10-15 years ago. I was a quality manager in a plant. And, you know, if we had any failures of any kind with any of our customers, and these are generally quality failures, not reliability failures, but it was the same principle. You know, we were flying people out just to meet with the customer, check out, you know, how the product was being used and how many pieces are out there. Do we need to do any containment? So it was all hands on deck, and absolutely we were not releasing product that had known or suspected defects.
Right. I think that one of the things in the semiconductor with the chips is, so our customers were the people who made chips, and their customers were the people who purchased chips, somebody who purchases from Intel or Motorola. The inspection process at the end of a chip manufacturing process is more intense than anything I've ever seen. Every step of the chip making process has a very thorough inspection process. So you do one implant, you do an inspection, you do etching, you do an inspection. So the likelihood that a defective chip got out of the factory of Intel or Motorola's factory is very, very low, almost nothing. So their customers don't experience poor quality chips from having an implanter that is operating very inconsistently or on the edge. What happens is it's just a dollar thing for yield for them, right? How many wafers do they have to scrap that there was bad processes? But the new feature adds so much money that you can have a significant jump in poor yield, and it's still a net gain. And
I see.
Yeah. See. And their customer, and it doesn't hurt their brand at all because their customers never see it. So it's this very interesting situation where if the gain in speed or feature, because sometimes you can add a feature to a chip that dollar value wise, you can sell four chips and they yield as much profit as 20 chips of the previous generation or something, you know? So you can smash mess up a whole bunch of those and who cares? It's still a net gain. And your customers are super psyched that they have the latest, greatest. So yeah, it was this very unusual situation for us where the getting that latest feature to market trumped everything to such an amazing extreme. Reliability was still important because obviously you wanted to continually improve it. But with such an aggressive, you know, technological advancement, rate, it's interesting. It reminded me of like the car industry back in like 1900, 1910, 1920. Not that I was there. But, you know, back then cars were something that you either had to be a mechanic or have a mechanic on staff to own or use. You know, and if you look at year to year, the technology jumps were amazing. You know, a 5-year more, you know, newer model of a car back then was an entirely different machine. And so it was worth pushing all this technology out there that was unstable because it was advancing so quickly.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it's really, you know, it's interesting. Whereas now the technology is mature and there's zero tolerance for even the slightest issue. And so with implanters, if that technology comes to a point where, the jumps are less and less, they're going to be competing more in reliability. That'll begin to shift because those feature jumps aren't enough to make up for, you know, a poor yield.
Right.
So.
Yeah, but either the way you describe it, though, with the you know, taking care of the issue with yield, you're still protecting the customer, right? I mean, yeah. So that they do have that in common.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's why that was permissible because, you know, if whoever Dell is buying the Intel chips, Dell doesn't want their customers to have a high failure rate, and they don't because the inspection process is so insanely thorough. You know, their inspection process in chip manufacturing is almost higher tech than the making it process. You know, it's the being able to examine how the crystal structure of silicon was modified and healed after you implanted a boron atom. You know, that inspection equipment is just as sophisticated and complex as the manufacturing equipment. So not much gets by it, you know.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting. So then there's those two extremes with regard to how reliability priority balances with other things. And you were beginning to talk about also the variability of methods and tools that are commonly pulled out of the toolbox. What would you say your like top three reliability tools are that you you know, are a part of your programs consistently.
Right. Well, when you say tools, I think you're referring to like methods for accelerated yes. testing, that sort of thing.
Yeah, accelerated life testing. Like you said, HALT is not a tool that you know, you go to.
Yeah, we do a lot of reliability demonstration, both success-based and testing to failure. So that's just real classical stuff, right? Mm. With Weibull plots and demonstrating your reliability at any given time, reliability growth. We're starting to get involved a little more in that than we have. Mm-hmm. Trying to think of what else. We have done some step stress testing. So MIOST, I don't know if you've heard the expression MIOST, multiple environment overstress test.
Oh, no, I haven't. Tell me. I mean, I get the idea and probably kind of have done it informally, but I didn't know that acronym for it.
Yeah, it's actually an acronym, I think, that came out of the Shannon folks, that consulting group a number of years back. But it's really a quantitative step stress approach. You know, a lot of folks will do step stress sort of informally, kind of like you do a HALT, where you're just stepping it up and you're looking for qualitative information, you know, about when does it fail, how many steps and what stress levels is it getting to when you fail, and what are the failure modes and do they need to be, is that something that needs attention in order to make our product robust? Where MIOST has a little bit more rigor to it, so it's semi-quantitative. Mm. So there's some rigor into how you define the step size in terms of the delta stress and the delta time. And if you follow the rigor and you complete the process, then you get a result that you can actually plot on a Weibull plot. And the difference is, you know, because you're stepping stress and time as you go, your x-axis on your Weibull plot is not just time, but it's stress time.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so it's a completely different way of looking at it. It's still quite qualitative. I still consider it, I describe it as semi-quantitative. Hmm. So you do get, you know, you do get a Weibull plot, but you get it on the stress time axis. And so it's really, it's still something that's better, a better tool for A-B comparisons.
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can put, you know, your one life target is still, you know, a point on the plot. So you still get some idea of margin as well as your A versus B comparisons.
Yep. Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, and plus it has the advantage of as most step stress programs do, you get failures in a short period of time. So you get that qualitative aspect. What, you know, what are my failure modes and how important do we think they are?
Yep. Well, good. All right. To our listeners, we're going to take a quick break to hear a message from our sponsorship, and we'll be right back.
Kirk Gray here to mention that John Paskowitz and I published a book, Next Generation HALT and HAS, Robust Design of Electronics and Systems, which provides the basics of applying HALT and HAS and reveals how HALT and HAS can discover software issues also. To find out more and get a copy, go to exendoreliability.com/go/HALT.
Okay, we're back. And John, you just were telling us about this, you know, step stress testing, this new methodology, which that is new to me. I hadn't heard about it before, and it sounded great. You know, it's the being able to take both time and the step stress and to use it as a comparator for A to B testing. And that's really neat. That's a great tool.
Yeah, you know, if that tool piques your interest, there's another technique that you and I and our colleagues discussed when we got together a week or two ago. I think we call it cumulative damage. It's an accelerated testing method.
Yeah.
That we call cumulative damage modeling.
Right. It was based on Miner's rule.
Yeah, basically, it takes advantage of that principle, mm-hmm. Although it's an entirely empirical approach.
Yeah.
So if you're interested, I'd like to sort of share that with you as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, please.
Okay. So, and you know, my ulterior motive is I'm always looking for other folks to come up with examples of this, because this is one to me that I think is very powerful and has the potential to have a lot of application, but I have not seen it used very often. So in general, what you do is, this is a situation that you can use, or an application you can use, when you've got a mature product that is in the field. So in the field doesn't have to be, you know, in production, high volume production. It could be that you've got product on pilot vehicles or with pilot customers. So it could still be in some kind of beta phase. But the idea is, you get back some of these products from the field. So you anywhere from, you know, just a few hours or miles of exposure all the way out to well beyond one life. But you get some of these products back from the field, and you run them on your bench test. So let's say you have a bench test that is perhaps not very well correlated to the field, but it is something that exercises the right stresses, the stresses that you think matter mm-hmm. to the field. So you take these products back that have different amounts of exposure in the field, and you run them on your bench test, and you run them to failure. And as long as the failure mechanisms in the field align with the failure mechanisms on your test, then you should get a decreasing slope as you, in other words, that let's start by, if you take parts with very little exposure in the field, you're going to get a pretty high time to failure on your bench test mm-hmm. once you run those on your test, right? So, and as you get more and more exposure in the field, once you put those on your test in the lab, the times to failure will get less and less. So eventually the parts in the field that come back that have high exposure will not survive very long at all on your test. And you end up getting a correlation between your lab test and your field test, which has a lot of value. It allows you to do, you know, once you've validated that model or constructed it and then validated it, allows you to do some predictive things with very little time in the field, or even no time in the field. But it's a way to correlate your lab test entirely with empirical methods.
Wow, and once you've done that, you can take any design changes or iterations or anything and very quickly, you know, see how they would perform comparatively in the field. That's really powerful.
Right, and it's not, you know, a lot of accelerated tests, you're going to get folks that are going to be a little skeptical of the correlation, where this one, if you've done, you know, done the work where you've taken parts from the field and run them to failure on your test and made that correlation, it's kind of hard to argue with how true that acceleration factor is.
Yeah. Oh, that's really neat. Yeah. I'm going to look in more of that. I'm going to ask you to share some material, anything else you have on that.
Yeah, I've got some training materials with five or six slides on a case study that I'd be happy to share with you.
Oh, we could even put a link to that in this episode if that's okay.
Possibly. I may have to, look it over to make sure we're not All right. giving away any house secrets.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll check on that. But the people listening to this already know the answer to that because they can see if it's linked or not. they already know the outcome, even though we don't.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, I'd be happy to. And even if it's something we have to be careful about, I'm sure I can do something with the slides to make this work.
Oh, great. Oh, that's really good. So that's interesting. Yeah, you know what's funny? Another observation I have industry to industry is the constraints of the, I don't want to say legal system, but their industry standards or certifications, how it affects their reliability testing. So one of the most dramatic ones is the FDA. And I've worked directly for medical companies, and probably almost like half of my, you know, clientele tends to be medical. And it's so interesting, the environmental shift when the FDA is, you know, that you have to satisfy FDA requirements in addition to your own, you know, field performance that you want. It reminds me so much of the way we critique standardized testing for kids in school, where you do the standardized testing, which of course creates this kind of metric that you can use across a very broad population. But the downside is very evident, is that now the education programs are geared towards that. And they some of the opportunities for learning or, you know, diversity in the knowledge or specializing the knowledge is lost. And, you know, the criticism is that kids are just getting taught to the test and not taught to learn.
Right.
And I really feel the same way when I directly look at comparing products that are under FDA scrutiny and trying to get, you know, in the process of trying to get their approval in addition to ones that are not. And so much of their testing and the where they use their resources geared towards satisfying these FDA requirements, when it becomes quite evident in a lot of steps that there would be great benefit in doing other types of testing to help improve the product. But you can't direct the resource away, or the schedule time usually is the major constraint to do that. So there's all these opportunities to improve the product or to measure it in a way that's more applicable to predicting performance that get shelved just because you have to do the tests that, you know, are required for certification. So it's kind of this weird backfire of this regulation, which commonly happens. You know, that's the plus minus to regulation, right?
It's all well-meaning, right? Because they have these schedules that, for example, emissions tests for emissions-related products.
Yeah.
There are schedules where you're supposed to run your vehicle through this certain drive schedule and then pass emissions. And then, of course, you can design your products as I think they call them schedule beaters or test beaters, right?
Yeah.
Which is exactly what you're saying. It's designed for that particular test.
Right.
But falls short in other drive schedules.
Sure. I mean, I love the FDA, you know, process when I'm in the doctor's office or at the pharmacy. I mean, I'm very grateful for it, but because I would not want to be in a medical system that did not have regulation like that. But then when I'm on the other side and I'm seeing a product that, like, oh, if we did this or something like you just described this, like we could do this intermittent step stress test, it'd be great for baseline, seeing if we could change this or that, or, you know, and like, no, we can't. We have to do our X, you know, standard test, and that's where our resource is going. You know, I'm like, it's too bad. But yeah, so yeah. It's kind of interesting. So it's very much two different worlds when, you know, I'm in FDA world or not FDA world. I see that as quite a clear, you know, designator into the program style.
Right.
That was great. That was really good. I really like that topic. And it is so interesting. It's us as colleagues getting together, you know, talking about that. And and like you said, your perspective's unique, having been in a single industry for over three decades.
Yeah, and as you know, I've just, you know, in the last 6-9 months been involved in, you know, opening my horizons, if you will, to other industries. And I really encourage that for folks that are sort of have their blinders on and all they know is what they know.
Yeah.
Actually,
it's funny. I have a small story on that. When I hit 10 years in semiconductor, at that point, they had gotten me an executive advisor, a VP who could, you know, kind of groom you. They were like, hey, we want this. And it backfired on them because I hit my 10-year mark and he and I were doing one of our monthly meetings. And he's like, you kind of have to make a decision at 10 years. If you stay in an industry longer than 10 years, you're kind of risking becoming a lifer, right? Because it becomes more and more difficult for you to go to something else. Whereas at 10 years, if you transition, you're kind of opening yourself up to the ability to be more dynamic and diverse, and it's a good time to change. And I ended up leaving and going to medical, so that executive advisor backfired for the company.
Okay, well,
but I am grateful.
I took the other approach. I've been in the same company for 30 plus years.
Yeah. Oh, too funny. Well, great.
It's all good.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. Okay, well, thanks so much. And everybody listening, we'll see if that link is at the bottom to learn more about that stress test method. It was very interesting. And we look forward to any other comments. Take care.
Thanks, Adam.
Thanks, John. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.